This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tuesday, November 22nd edition of the DRF Players Podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you in the Brooklyn bunker for just a few more hours before I take off for Thanksgiving down in Northern Virginia. We've got a lot of ways we could refer to this show. It's the 191st edition of the show. Got ahead of myself there by 100 episodes or so. That could happen. It's the November 22nd edition. It's the Thanksgiving edition. For it, I am joined by the usual crew from the DRF offices in Manhattan. If you can hear him with all the hammering and construction going on around him, we have Mike Hogan.
Hello, Pete.
And from somewhere in Texas, we have Jonathan Kitchen, who's having no technical problems at all today. How are you, JK?
Yeah, this is all the other editions you named. This is the Jonathan's Wi-Fi's not working, his headphones are broken, speakerphone Skype edition of the podcast as well.
As a result, we're going to be a little bit shorter than usual today, not least because, as Mike pointed out, we have some vehicular issues today. Long story I won't bore you with, but basically, you know, people who live in Brooklyn, they understand these things. Not all of us have fancy modes of transportation like private planes, like Jonathan Kitchen, to take them around. I rely on a good old-fashioned automobile, and I have to go move it for 90 minutes so it doesn't get ticketed. Alternate side of the street rules in effect here on the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. So that's why we moved the show up an hour. I think the long-term plan, not least to avoid my having to move the car in the middle of the show, is going to be to do a Monday 11 a.m. show and a Friday 11 a.m. show. Do you guys like that idea as a general schedule going forward? Obviously, it may be tweaked based on a number of things, but as a concept, how do you feel about that, Mike Hogan?
Yeah, it's fine by me. You know, I'm here Monday through Friday, as long as there's no holidays on either day, on either week. The only thing we'll have to figure out is often there are Monday holidays. Do we do a Tuesday show on those?
I think a Tuesday sub for that might work. Saratoga season, maybe it makes sense to move to the dark day. You know, we can be a little bit loosey-goosey with the stuff. Listeners, if you have any preferences, especially those of you who've been joining us regularly on Spreaker, you know, you can listen to the show live either by finding us on Spreaker or clicking a link that I send out at the start of every show through my @loomsboldly Twitter account. If you guys have any preferences for when we rock and roll, we'd love to hear it. We'll try to accommodate. We all have other real jobs. You know, the podcast is an entirely freelance endeavor, ad hoc, so may not be able to accommodate, but give us a try. Let us know what you think. We will not have a show this Friday because of the holiday, but I did want to very quickly have a few things I want to talk about today, including some bigger issues in terms of the sort of biggest questions in racing right now from a sporting point of view revolving around Arrogant and California Chrome. But before we get to that, we do have some great racing this weekend. I'll admit, I haven't had a chance to look. All of my spare thoughts have been on making the perfect turkey stock and gravy and how to get the skin perfectly crispy. And we'll talk about Thanksgiving a little bit more as the show goes on today, too. But just curious if either of you guys have had a chance to even look to offer any sort of preview on some of the horses who might be showing up this weekend. Anybody have any horses to watch who've been entered coming this Saturday? It's at either Southern California, at Churchill Downs, at Aqueduct. Lots of big racing all around the country. Mike, we'll start with you. Anything you're looking forward to?
Well, I don't think they've drawn yet for Saturday. I could be wrong. But there is some good racing on Thanksgiving. There's a few stakes on the Aqueduct card, including the Fall Highway, which is always a nice, fun little race each year. You know, we talked a little bit about Stall Walking Dude on the show on Friday. Of course, he scratched from the Laurel Dash. He's showing up in the Fall Highweight. He is the high weight. I think he's carrying 134, and he's obviously a player there. And this is a weird time of year for stakes races on the East Coast, because there's so many in a span of 5 days. There's the one at Parks. There's that one at Laurel. Weekend Hideaway was entered in four different races in the span of 5 days. I'm not sure which one he's going to go in. But that's why you get a lot of scratches decimating certain races.
Let's face it. Let me just interrupt Mike for a second to just point out how gross this is. You know, there are so many instances of racing failing to do itself any favors by, rather than acting as a sport, as any kind of collective entity, by acting like a number of independent fiefdoms all out for themselves without regard to anything else. I mean, to me, there's just no better example. Races that with any degree of coordination could be presented as a series throughout the year where everybody mm-hmm. would benefit. But no, instead, let's have them all in 1 week. It's just nuts. But that end of soapbox rant there.
Mm-hmm.
Jonathan, how about you? Any horses? Maybe I don't know if they've drawn, but, you know, we have some idea of who's being pointed where. Anybody you're in particular looking forward to seeing run this weekend?
I've always been a Clearly Now fan who's running in the Thanksgiving handicap at Fairgrounds. So I'll probably do my normal embarrassing Thanksgiving feast, stuff my face with literally all I eat is bread, corn, mashed potatoes, gravy, and turkey. Like, I don't eat any of that other stuff. Literally.
Vegetable-free zone.
Yeah, I eat as much of that as I possibly can, and then I'll sit down and hope Clearly Now is still a racehorse, just as a fan. And then the stakes at Churchill. Churchill's got a great card with the Fall City Handicap. Kind of looking for that new standout in the older filly and mare division with you know, our older ones kind of going to the – well, with Beholder and Untappable usually would run in a race similar to this at Churchill. So with them being gone, it's kind of a new search. So those are some races I'll be looking forward to, but nothing that I've been looking to bet back yet. We'll see maybe about the weekend.
Let me ask you this.
Let me mention something else real quick about the Fall Highway. I love Green Grotto. I love Green Grotto here.
I have not looked at the races. Is he loose in there?
I think he could be. I mean, it's not a given. There's some other horses with speed, but I think he may just be fastest early. And I tweeted out in the Bold Ruler, I didn't think he was going to win, but I knew he was going to set the pace and tire, and I thought I was going to set him up for some sort of stakes race at Aqueduct. I think the Fall Highway might be it. We always have the Gravesend.
Some ideas for your Thanksgiving Day wagering from Mike Hogan. Let me ask you this, Jonathan. Is your handicapping more of a no-closer zone, or is your Thanksgiving eating more of a no-vegetable zone? Give us your perspective.
Ooh, we're gonna need the shutter cam for this one. It's probably Thanksgiving and no vegetable zone.
I have seen you bet closers. I have seen you bet Kobe's back. So yeah, I've never seen you eat a Brussels sprout on Thanksgiving. So that's probably right. What about you, Mike? What are you have any Thanksgiving traditions to share? Do you do the cooking? What's the usual plan for you guys?
Well, you know, now that we're on the East Coast, of course, we've been here for — this will be the fourth Thanksgiving that we've been on the East Coast, and most of our — well, all of our family — I've got some family upstate, but they're a few hours away, and it's often tough to make it up there. So basically, our family is thousands of miles away, so we kind of have done our own thing or done something with friends. This year, we're going over to some friends' family's house. It's going to be a big family gathering that the Hogan family are crashing.
Awesome.
And hopefully we won't be kicked out and not invited back.
Yeah, you'll find out where you stand real quick.
Exactly.
Susan's family. Susan, her dad is a Navy man who grew — she, as a result, grew up in a lot of different houses. But the closest thing she had to a childhood home was this place in Northern Virginia that's actually being sold. So this will be sort of the last family Thanksgiving at the old homestead on her side of the family. So we'll be going down. I'm going to be getting thickly involved in the cooking. I plan on, if I were down there already, I'd be already working on the stock. To make the soup and the gravy and all that good stuff. But I'm hoping to get enough of a positive line on the cooking done that I can enjoy some wagering potentially of the NFL variety on Thanksgiving. But I'm sure I'll be looking at the horse racing as well. One other note I had from the weekend, I just apologies to anybody who followed along with me on DRF Live over the weekend. Dan Illman kind enough to invite me in. Speaking of not being invited back, I think I managed to not give out a winner in 10 races, which is kind of hard to do. And it was just one of those, experiences where I feel like the information was good, but it just wasn't my day. In any of the public tipping you've done, Jonathan, I feel like every time I see you on TV, you're giving out four winners. Have you ever had a dud, and you have any advice for me on how I might recover from it?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure I have. All I know is that I've given out more winners than a certain someone has on TQ, and that's something I'm very proud of.
Trolling, little very subtle trolling there on the DRF Players podcast today. We'll leave it to your imaginations, folks, as to who you might be discussing. Perhaps go back through his Twitter images and you might have an idea. All right, enough of that nonsense. Let's I don't think there's too much to recap from last weekend. I guess we could talk quickly about Guinevere, who I for one was wrong about. I'll just ask the question this way, Mike. Is this a case of just super clever spotting by conditions, skipping the Breeders' Cup Juvenile and finding a $1 million pot to grab? Or is this a horse who has to be taken seriously as we look to the Triple Crown coming up in 2017?
Boy, I kind of lean towards the former. I'm not convinced that he is a player. I think he might have just taken advantage of what was probably not the strongest field in a $1 million race. But we'll see. Maybe he'll prove me wrong.
Having a little bit of an audio issue there, Mike. I don't know if that's my end or yours. I heard we got most of what you said, but there was some cutting out. So just as a FYI, if you can check your internet status. But I think we should be hopefully okay as we go forward. Jonathan, I'll ask you the same question about Guinevere.
You know, that race never really does a lot for me. Excuse me. Obviously, last year's winner in my well-publicized opinion of him is evidence of that, but
one turn it's horse. Never really, it's a one turn horse.
It's never really got me going. It's such a weird race in the idea that it's run down in Louisiana where there's not a lot of 2 year old prepping kind of going on. It's run in kind of a bull ring setting. It's or at least a different type of configuration. And
oh, it's a bull ring.
The other thing. Follows up, you know, 2 weeks of a race with a heck of a lot more prestige. And so to me, it's always kind of the second tier. And winners out of that race or runners out of that race just have to prove it to me. And so I reserve judgment until they show up against the big boys.
Hey, even when winners of that race like Exaggerator do theoretically prove it to you by going on with lots of good grade one efforts, you still don't like them. So maybe you have something as a Texan. Do you just have something against Louisiana?
No, I like Louisiana. I like Louisiana.
I'm just giving you a hard time. The other big news from this week, of course, kind of annoying news from your point of view, Jonathan, as somebody who held a big fat future ticket on Not This Time going to be retired. What are your feelings coming out of that, hearing that news?
It's too bad for the horse. It's part of why a future bet is a future bet. I've had some pretty cool future bets working in the past. Nothing probably as cool as this one. I had I Want Revenge at like 20-1 maybe when I was in college or when I was, I guess it was right after college. And then he scratched the morning of as the favorite. But other than that, I haven't really done a lot of future wagering. And so yeah, it's part of it. It's part of doing that. It's why you get the numbers you get. But at the same time, I feel more bad for the sport and for the Romans and the owners and the connections for having such a talented horse. And now, they're the ones that are really suffering. So no big deal. Go Mastery and we'll see what happens.
That's right. You also have your future bet on Mastery. I agree. From a sporting point of view, I was watching that amazing Breeders' Cup Juvenile again. I was just getting in the mind frame of, wow, we've got a potential rivalry brewing. We've got something that could be really cool to see going forward. And I do feel a little bit robbed of that. But, you know, that's the nature of the game. What do they say? Horses are like strawberries. They can go bad overnight. And apparently that's what happened here. Anything to add on that front? Mike, we got your tech issue sorted out there?
I hope so. It's the Wi-Fi in the studio, I think, is a little bit iffy, but I moved the phone, which is where I'm calling from, potentially a little closer to where the Wi-Fi signal is. So hopefully we're good. My take on the Not This Time thing is, yeah, I agree. It's a shame. It's a disappointment. For me, I just wanted to see the horse, even if he's got an issue. Okay, he's off the Triple Crown trail, whatever. I don't see why they had to retire him. I mean, I understand, I get it, you know, they're going to strike while the iron's hot, and then you get 15,000 for each mare he covers this season at stud, but boy, come on.
Well, I think it's pretty simple. When I've always felt like when there's a question that I can't answer, then there's typically more information that I don't have, and to me, it's maybe very clear that the horse, especially by what happened to the horse's brother, there's something that's was not sound, and this unsoundness that would have been exposed if explained openly would affect his marketing value. And so they just say it's a tendon and move on. And I'm not saying they're lying, and I'm not saying it's not a tendon, because to be honest with you, hanging around the Breeders' Cup, I talked to someone who's very prominent in the breeding industry, and they had told me prior to the race that he had a vet issue and didn't vet for a stallion deal. So, but he ran as well as he ran. So I just assumed that it was something that they were going to be able to work around. And so I think there's more to it than what the surface says.
There usually is. And I don't mean to, I'm not commenting on this situation specifically, and, you know, please don't say that I was, but there's just been so many situations I've heard of where you're hanging around industry people. And again, not talking about this situation, but just other surprise or early retirements. And you'll hear industry insiders say, gee, I wonder what the issue really was. So I do think sometimes there can be more than meets the eye here to your question, Mike. But again, not casting any aspersions about Not This Time. Hopefully he'll go on and be a great stallion and show some of that brilliance that he demonstrated in his short time on the racetrack. We had another Breeders' Cup question come in from listener and friend of the podcast, Jim Timmink, who wanted to know, JK, a little more. We talked about your Breeders' Cup betting challenge. We talked about busting out on Yellow Agate. He was really curious to know what your strategy was heading into the Breeders' Cup contest. I thought it was a good question. I think a lot of people think about these live bankroll betting contests, and they don't really know how to approach like a big picture strategy. They just think about going race to race and betting minimums. And I think Jim was correctly guessing that there was a little bit more to it than that for you coming into the BCBC. I don't think you're giving away too much to outline what your strategic approach is in these live bankroll situations.
Yeah. Early on Friday, I mean, well, it depends. It's different. It's never the same. That's the first thing I'll say. And because you have to kind of play. I always say that you got to take what the defense gives you, the defense being the racing secretary. So, and so that's kind of, and the horses that are also entered. And so what I did on Friday was I had a plan that I was going to take a pretty significant swing with Good Samaritan. And I did so. I swung pretty good on Good Samaritan. And there was an undercard race. I can't remember what it was, and I bet a little bit of money. And then when it got to Beholder, I had kind of run the bank roll lower than I had hoped that it was going to be. So I kind of played that race a little bit more defensively and less aggressively than I think I wanted to, and kind of pretty much got back to where I was to start the day. So I started kind of right where I was on Saturday morning. And then when I went to bed Saturday night, I knew I was going to go every dollar I had, I was going to bet on Yellow Agate. So I knew that I was going to, and I messed around a little bit early with a Wesley Ward horse down the hill, but I didn't blow much money, and that's what I did. I bet $4,000 to win on her, and then like $600 worth of exactas with her running second that would have got me back all my money if she would have somehow got nailed at the wire, but We didn't get an opportunity to see that. So.
So it sounds to me like basically you're saying that you want to find, you're going to look at whatever your live bank contest is. You're going to look at the contest as a whole. You're going to find your strongest opinions, and you're going to try to get as much of your money in as possible in those places where your opinions are strongest. I would say that's generally speaking a very good idea, regardless of which live bank contest it is. Am I expressing that correctly?
Yeah, absolutely. I tell you what I don't do is I don't bet minimums the show ever.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a logic to playing. I'm not saying you have to bet show, but I do think there's a logic to playing somewhat more. Let's say you have those, you know, two spots on Friday and two spots on Saturday where you're willing to risk close to everything. It's just logical to me that if you have opinions that strong in those spots, that some sort of more conservative type of play is maybe appropriate in those minimum spots. Is that how you look at it, or not even? Are you more saying go big or go home every time you're risking bank? I would play conservatively in those places where I didn't have the strong opinion, just to preserve bankroll to be able to go with great gusto where I have the strong opinion. Is that your idea, or do you look at it a different way? JK, I got to cut you off, man. I got to cut you off. We're just having one of those shows today where the technology is just not cooperating. We'll come back to that question sometime. Hopefully, we'll be able to get you back where we can hear you here. I'm not sure he heard any of that.
You just
came back.
Yeah, no, I heard it all.
Oh, you heard what I was saying?
Yeah, no, I'm saying it kind of hurts my brain to think about that. Like, I'm just not wired that way. If there's a $600 minimum that I have to meet, I believe in myself and my opinion enough that if I'm going to risk the $600, I would rather risk the $600 for a 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 4-to-1 return on my money rather than a risk the $600 for a break even return on my money. I just don't, I'm not crazy about it. I get it. It makes sense. You do want to preserve your bankroll for other opportunities, but it's not something I've typically done in the past.
When you've won contests, I think you've won them in some instances, not on necessarily your strongest opinion, but just by cleverly betting $500 in a trifecta in a race where you had a pretty good opinion. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, every live tournament I've won, I've only won two, right? Three. Anyways, the ones I've done well in, no, I've never like really just like crushed something. It's just been, you know, like little spots here and there where I'm just making money. You know, here's the thing is like, if you can take your $600 minimum or $300 minimum and you bet that and you turn it into $700-$800, that's 500 more dollars. I call them free dollars. You can now bet more aggressively that doesn't really affect your overall outlook. And that's kind of what happened. Like the Gulfstream tournament that I won, I remember walking in, it was the day that Mohamed debuted, and there's a Linda Rice in there. And I just did an exacta box with those two horses for a minimum, like $150 exacta box with those two horses, got back like $600. Bet that $600 into a tri pool later that turned out to be like a $10,000 score, you know? So.
Yeah, I think it's also different for me. I mean, you have a very different philosophy than I would about it, and that's great. I mean, different people have different ways of getting the job done. I will point out that what we've seen in the BCBC does seem to point to the idea of the one big score that we've seen people certainly win $100,000 in prize money taking the approach you're talking about. But I feel like that ability to just crush one race seems like year in, year out is what gets it done at the BCBC. Do you think there's anything to that, or do you think it's just a matter of time before the approach you're describing has success in the biggest live bank contest of them all? Did we lose Jonathan again? I don't know what's going on here.
Well, I got greedy. I thought we had him back, and then we lost him. But anyway, it's just an interesting difference of philosophy that he and I have about those spots. Oh, I hear him percolating in the background now.
He's trying.
He's fighting through. So what's going on, JK? What's your problem today, Mike? What's the tech situation going on?
Something's wrong with my Wi-Fi. I don't know what it is. I'm trying to sort it out.
You can't plug in somehow to something?
No, I'm losing.
All right. Well, we'll just do the best we can. Let's move on from that topic. I think we have more than enough to satisfy the question that was asked. And, boy, you know, I know what I wanted to talk about today, but it's a big, good question, and I don't know if I want it on a podcast that I'm hoping not that many people listen to because the tech was so poor. So I'm considering taking a super left turn, but I don't think I don't know. Well, let's throw it to Mike for a second. I know, Mike, you had some sort of general betting philosophy stuff that you were thinking about talking about today. Let's see if we can round out the last. We're just going to do another 20 minutes today. It's going to be a short show for obvious reasons. Let's just fill that 20 minutes with some racing chatter we've been wanting to get off our chest, and we'll save the big ticket item that I was going to talk about that I teased earlier for a show when we have more time and everybody's tech is working.
Well, it's kind of a point and a question for you guys. Do you guys have any? I don't want to call them angles necessarily, but certain trainers, certain moves, certain things that you look for that will make you pay attention or that you love time and time again to bet against. That's sort of the question and discussion I wanted to have if we had time.
Yeah, I think we have time to talk about something like that. In my case, I mean, sure, you can't. There are certain meets, a meet like Saratoga, where I think obviously the fundamentals of handicapping are still really, really important. But also because so many trainers point for them and them alone, well, not them alone, but them above all else all year, you have what I've heard described as a more angle-specific meet. And you'll see things year in, year out at these meets that can yield dividends. Just thinking back historically to a meet like Saratoga, I think this was more true a few years ago. Problem with all these sort of angles is that over time, markets are smart, real smart. And over time, people figure this stuff out and that whatever inefficiency is there gets corrected. So something that'll work for a time isn't necessarily going to continue to work. And something that has not worked over time can suddenly start to work great. But a couple of things that just pop in my mind for a meet like Saratoga, Canadian shippers. I used to do very well with Canadian shippers at Saratoga. And I still find that they can often be a decent value. One thing that I noticed this year was it sure seemed like horses who were prepping at Fair Hill, particularly in race situations where stamina was going to come into play, longer turf races or 7-furlong races maybe for younger horses. It seemed like the horses training at Fair Hill had some sort of a little bit of a baked-in advantage that the market wasn't necessarily picking up on. Over the years, and I've talked about this ad nauseum on the show, and sometimes I miss it in the real world, but the idea of specific trainer Bill Mott, when he has a target, when I know that he's had a horse laid out for a certain race, not for weeks, but for months, I always, always, always expect that horse to run better in that race that he circled long ago than whatever the bear form suggests. Those are a few of them that pop out to me. Mike, did you have a specific point you wanted to make about Bill Mott? Am I remembering that right from a conversation we had before?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Bill Mott because that's one of my favorites. And you mentioned the market. The market, I think, has almost gotten too wise to Bill Mott and Bill Mott's trends. And I think the market completely understands that Bill Mott is not going to have his two-year-olds. Jonathan uses the word cranked, but, you know, he's going to use the first start with his two-year-olds to just kind of see what he has. He's not going to, unlike Todd Pletcher, get them ready to run 95 buyers in their first start as a two-year-old. He's going to take more of his time. They generally don't win. The market understands that. they almost never bet them accordingly. And I looked, I actually looked in Formulator last 5 years. Bill Mott has had 253 two-year-old first-time starters. Do you want to guess how many of them went favored?
I mean, it can't be many.
Four. Four.
I would have taken the under on that, actually.
So, yeah, four out of 253, that's 1.5%, went favored. And 11%, only 28 of them, were 5-1 or lower. So the market understands Bill Mott doesn't win first out. The point that I want to make is that the market almost overcorrects for the second time Bill Mott starts a two-year-old. And this is what I wanted to talk about. I love betting against Bill Mott's second-time starters because the market thinks that they're, okay, this is the time. And especially if they run well first out, those horses get bet down to even money. They get bet down to odds on. And Bill Mott, second-time starters, okay, four out of 253, that's 1.5% first-time starters are favored. Second-time starters, 19% of them are favored. And 54% of them, more than half of them, get bet down to 5-1 or less. And the thing is, the ROI is not really any better for the second-time starters than they all are for the aggregate with the first-time starters.
What is the
strike
rate?
Better.
What is the strike rate go from firsters to second? Do you have it in front of you?
I do. For just general, I mean, this is all starters. I'm going to remove some of my filters. Two-year-olds, and we're looking at two-year-olds. He actually does much better with his three-year-old first-time starters. He wins at a pretty decent rate, but he's 4% win rate, $6 ROI, 21% in the money with all two-year-old first-time starters. The second-time starters, and this includes those handful that won first out, he jumps up to 14% win rate, which is much better. But when you think about half of those being 5-1 or lower, and nearly 20% of those being favored, 14% is not really that great. $1.24 ROI. So the ROI goes up a little bit, but it doesn't shoot up by any stretch of the imagination. And only 43% hit the board. When you think about 54% of them being 5-1 or lower, that's a play against in my book.
That's interesting. Have you gone further and looked at it? The two things I'd want to know is it a case where he doesn't give them one start, he gives them two, and the third start numbers improve? Or is there any difference between the sexes? Because as we've noted before on this show, fillies and colts often very different to train at two, the lighter framed fillies typically being easier to get fit. And that plays into some trainers' training styles more than with colts. Curious if you've looked at either of those in depth, Mike, or if not, maybe that's something we can talk about on a future show.
Yeah, I haven't looked at either of them in depth, but I can quickly look at fillies versus colts. Here's the odd thing. It's slightly skews more towards females. First-time starters with females wins at 4%, so hold steady. The ROI is a little better, $1.40. The ROI drops to 72 cents with the colts first out as two-year-olds in the at a 3% rate. Second out, it's 16% win rate versus 12% win rate. ROI doesn't really shoot through the roof either way. It kind of holds steady at about the 120 to 130% rate. So, we probably could dive a little deeper based on surface, based on class, you know, how many of these are in for maiden claiming versus maiden special weight, time of year. A lot of that is a factor as well. Because the strange thing that I've noticed is – the sense that Bill Mott firsters don't run doesn't really play out once they hit three. He actually does really well comparatively compared to what the market thinks with three-year-old firsters.
You also have to remember that even with two-year-olds, I mean, you know, not this year, but last year at Saratoga, he won with two in a week. And those two were touting themselves in the paddock. I remember Maggie Wolfendale with Sight Read in particular, talking about how this horse was ready to run And being there myself in the paddock for both of those and seeing some clues versus the normal firsters. So, of course, you know, we look at these stats. They're great. They give context. But it's also always good to look at this stuff in a meat-specific way. And also just remember that horses are individuals, not just data points on a graph, and things can change in a hurry. JK, how about you when it comes to certain pet angles, either for or against horses that you look at regularly? Anything spring to mind for you?
Not necessarily. I mean, while you guys were talking, I was thinking I'm not much of like an angle guy when it comes to that type of stuff, because to me, the idea that Bill Mott is better second out, it's real. He is better second out. But I think what the problem is that Mike's pointing out is that the market in the win pool and in terms of your ROI is affected because everyone knows that. But for me, it doesn't really matter to me. I'm not tossing a Bill Mott second time out that looks live in my pick fours, pick fives, second, you know, first and second, and then exact the Dutches, doubles, pick threes, all those things. So it doesn't really matter to me if that's the case. I'm going to use the horse regardless. So I think it's more of a deal when you're trying to find real value in the win pools. But that's why I usually like to play inside of the multi-race pools, because I feel like the value kind of maintains itself a little bit more there than it does in the win pool.
Logical.
I don't know. I mean, I can see your point, but I kind of take a different view of it, and I look at it as those sorts of opportunities are providing additional value on other horses, because whether you're right, yeah, they do win maybe three times as much as the firsters do, but the market so overcorrects that it provides value for every other horse in the race.
I think it comes down to what kind of a bankroll you're operating with. I think to Jonathan's point, he's still going to be eking out that value, Mike, that you describe when one of those longer priced horses in the multis wins, because he'll presumably have that horse too. Whereas, you know, having watched both of you play, Mike's playing a lot tighter tickets, looking to get a much bigger return on investment than Jonathan is. Jonathan's looking to risk more money and maybe not get the same ROI, but to also win at a higher strike rate than Mike is. So I think both of your attitudes make perfect sense to me from where you're coming from in terms of the way you're constructing your wagers. Will you allow me that?
Oh, for sure. And I'm not saying that you want to use this as a guide to, no matter what, always toss a Bill Mott second time starter. It all has to do with how you're handicapping, and this is just a factor that overlays as something additional to everything else you're seeing in the PPs and in the pedigree and in the race replays and whatnot. So I don't use it as a hard and fast rule. But what I do is I go into my handicapping already knowing that a certain horse, regardless of what I see on the morning line, just knowing Bill Mott second time starter, I am automatically think underlay.
All right. Jonathan, you have anything else on that? I have a couple of excellent listener comments I want to get to, but have we buttoned that up good enough?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. These both come from one of the top 10 punters in the UK today, Rob Dove. One is a Department of Corrections thing. We talked about whether or not the Santa Anita drop on the downhill course is high compared to drops in Europe. It is not at all. He brought to my attention a couple of ones, the most extreme example being the 5 furlong sprint at Epsom, where they drop 30 feet in a furlong as opposed to the 25 feet at Santa Anita over 3 furlongs. So I just thought that was a good point to say that there are far more hilly surfaces in the UK than the Santa Anita downhill. I really think that when it comes to the lack of success those horses have had at Santa Anita, the biggest thing is that the UK sprinters, I mean, they just don't seem to really measure up worldwide. It would be interesting to see what were to happen if we were to see sprinters from a country like Australia that's a lot more well-known for their sprinters ever contest that race. But racing calendar wise, I don't think it makes all that much sense. Dove's other comment was about, and this is worth going back to because it could maybe be more of a debate than we made it when we talked about it the first time. And we had some comments in the Spreaker comments section about it as well. And I think Mike was sympathetic to that. It has to do with the idea of the quality of the ride on California Chrome and how many people, and including trainer Art Sherman and Mike and his comments post-race, mentioned the idea about what would have happened if Chrome had opened up earlier in the race. And Dove's comment was I thought, worth sharing. He says, California Chrome opens up, maybe he goes a length further clear. But if he does that, he has to use more energy, and maybe he gets beat more in the end. I don't think he was capable of going five clear and really putting the race to bed. He's just a horse that goes in hand. It's the jockey's job to ration that finishing effort. And if you use too much of that energy early in a race, it can cost you more expensive lengths at the finish. I thought that was a really, really interesting point that he expressed the way that I viewed the classic better than I could have in words. And I was curious to get both of your takes on that. Jonathan, we'll start with you.
No, I think there's a lot to that point. I think the biggest part is that, and the biggest question is the same with the Beholder situation two races back against Stellar Wind when I had kind of clamored that I wish she would have opened up. You never really know until they try it, but I would prefer get beat with the attempt to open up rather than the attempt to outfinish a closer with a horse who's forwardly placed.
I think that's fair. I mean, all that said, I mean, just do you think Victor rode the race improperly?
No, I mean, I'm not really a huge, I mean, no.
Because I agree with you about Beholder. I agree that in those previous races, I would have liked to see more aggression because I thought it was too, now I should look at the fractions before I go out on a limb and say this, but I feel like that was overly conservative. I feel like Victor was the correct amount of aggressive and he just got beat by a better horse on the day. That's just how I see it.
I don't necessarily think that what Victor did was incorrect. I'm pointing to the theory,
yes,
and acknowledging other people's suggestion that that might have been the case. I don't necessarily think that that was the case, but I do believe in that theory. I'm just not sure if that was the right spot for it.
I think, Mike, you had agreed with our loyal listener, Paul, who suggested in the comments that Victor rode the race not to lose, an opinion I don't necessarily agree with. But what do you think?
Yeah, the reason why I say that is because he just seems so, and I would say overly concerned with Arrogate.
All the looking around.
Know? Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. That looks terrible, and I don't like to see that. I just don't think it affected how fast the horse was going. I think it was more of an optics problem than an actual problem, but maybe I'm being too kind on it. I agree with you. I didn't like to see that.
I don't know, and I'll never know. But when I see a jockey that concerned with the competition, it makes me think that he's not focused or as focused as he should be on his own mount. And so it makes me wonder, especially when they get beat by, not that much, what would happen if he was actually paying attention to his own mount instead of paying attention to the horse that was behind him?
I have some sympathy for that point of view, though I'm not fully swayed. What do you think, JK?
Yeah, I mean, I've said it a million times. I'm not a fan of the rubbernecking, looking around the Johnny V. Uncle Mo trip. It just drives me crazy. Do you think it really matters
at the end of the day? I agree. I mean, I right along with you have yelled things like "just ride the horse" when we see that.
Yeah,
but
well,
do we really think at the end of the day it matters?
At the end of the day, does it matter in a game of inches? I have to say it does.
Okay.
When I've lost thousands of dollars over inches, and the idea that these horses are trained to take their cues from weight shifts from the jock, and I've got a jock looking around and turning his head and whipping all around when they're on a turn. I mean, no, it probably doesn't the majority of the time, but
it can.
Yes, I would prefer that they just keep their head down and ride the horse without looking back.
It's got to matter to some extent, right? I mean, it's sort of like weight. You know, there's a point where a pound or two is probably not going to make that much of a difference on a 1,200-pound animal going, you know, nearly 40 miles an hour. But there's a point where it does. And I don't know where that line is, but I'm kind of with Jonathan. I mean, let's use like football as an analogy. You've got a guy in the open field, just run to the end zone. Don't turn around and look where the defender is and how close he is to catching you. Just go.
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to that idea, and I do agree that in life it probably matters. And if you were talking about a horse that looked in deep stretch like they could have won and then ended up losing by a thin lip, maybe I would attribute that. But just to clarify, in this instance, I think Angel Cordero in his prime rides Chrome. I think Arrogate wins. Anybody want to disagree with that?
No, you're probably right.
I was still watching The Simpsons and Ninja Turtles when he was riding, but from what I've heard from people that I respect, that's definitely a true statement.
Okay, that's very funny. Jonathan, I know last show we cut you off. We got about 3 to 5 minutes left on the show today, so we can kind of go into final thought mode. Seems like we have the tech worked out just as we're about to go off the air. Typical. But you had a point you wanted to make, but I took it back from you. I didn't throw it your way.
Yeah, no, it was really cool. You know, it's we enjoy doing the show, and it's a lot of fun. And obviously we have to juggle our schedules at times, and it can be something that has to definitely be navigated. But the other day I was on a plane and I couldn't get enough Wi-Fi power to watch replays, and I somehow found myself reading comments on iTunes on the Players podcast. And man, it was really cool. We had a lot of really good loyal fans. And people saying a lot of nice stuff about us and about the show that we do, and it felt really good. And so I just wanted to say thanks everybody for listening and, you know, saying nice things on Twitter. It really does kind of help motivate us to navigate those tough times that we have to try to get through and get this show on the road. And so you know, it's really cool that they listen and really cool they say the nice things that they do.
I'm glad you said that. When I thank the fans at the end of every show for listening, you know, thank you all for listening, whether you're a fan or not, I suppose. I mean it from the bottom of my heart. I will point out the irony that one of the few negative comments on there was somebody ranting and raving about the tech issues we have. That listener's not going to be very happy when they listen to this show. Sorry, buddy.
No, but. Today is the day that the mixer is being delivered.
Really?
So,
oh, great.
Yes.
Now, that's not going to help us with our individual Wi-Fi connections, I'll say.
No, that's true, but it should help make things a little bit smoother.
I hope so. I mean, I'm still a little concerned about all the Skype being on one channel. So, like, I don't know, is there some magic way the mixer can balance that? Mike, have we thought this through about how much of a change it's going to make?
I believe so. I don't know. I mean, a mixer is a mixer. It's got a few channels. We just need to do a little bit of experimentation and figure out what works best for us. But
one thing I know that we'll have is the ability for us all to hear the sound that's being recorded and or broadcast. So that brings into play fun sound effects. I'll play a couple now. You guys can't hear them, but the people listening can hear the thunder cracking in the background. But we're going to get much cooler, more horse racing specific ones than that, including my dream overall to just have an extended, drawn out version of Trevor Denman saying blame to throw in there every now and again.
Zenyatta, 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 blame.
If we could have the actual recording and that's two different ones, and just, I don't know when it'll come up, but I have a feeling it will. So we're gonna have some fun with that for sure. Mike, how about you? Any other, a couple minutes left, any final thoughts on today's show?
No, I'm just excited for the holiday, excited for, I'm not excited for the cold. But I guess that's just the way it goes this time of year in New York. But yeah, just looking forward to taking a little time off and being with the family.
That has finally happened here, by the way, the cold. I was, you know, I make fun of horse players for their amateur conspiracy theories and cynicism, but I'm guilty of it as well. I woke up Sunday morning and I saw right away that Aqueduct had canceled. And the first thing I think is, oh, Like, the weather wasn't supposed to be that bad today. I wonder if this has anything to do with that carryover. Did they possibly want to have an extra day to build up the carryover? Like, how bad are these winds really? Then I go to walk the dog, and we're walking around Prospect Park, and I pretty much literally got blown into the middle of Prospect Park West from the gusts and realized, no, this really was not safe riding conditions. Kudos to Naira for doing the right thing, and, you know, being and shame on me for being a typical silly, cynical horse player in this instance. JK, how about you? Any closing thoughts for today's edition of the show?
No, that's it. I'm gonna eat some bread this weekend, I think.
I know that's unusual for you, right? You usually eschew the bread. Is this like your one weekend reprieve a year where you just get busy with the stuffing and potatoes and the lot?
Yeah, well, not the stuffing. Remember, I'm very strict diet. I do turkey, mashed potatoes, gravy, corn, and bread. That's it. So.
No green foods.
When you said bread, all stuffing is bread. You know, usually, I guess it could be rice. I was assuming that was included, but apparently not. The rules, they're very strict down there in the Kitchen House. All right, I think we've done enough. Apologies to folks. We didn't get into all the stuff we wanted to today, but we got a lot of winter shows. We're going to hopefully be doing some fun stuff coming up on this show. I want to try to do something special for our 200th episode that'll be coming up this winter. This week, we're just doing the one show, but going forward, we're going to look to do two shows a week this winter. Last year, we only did the one from this point to the end of the year, but we're going to try to get back to a two-show deal. We're going to ask your help in helping us program. Keep asking the great questions. You can hit us up on Twitter. You can send them to podcast@drf.com. Really quickly, DRF tournaments this weekend. We've got action Wednesday and Friday. We're off on Thursday. Back this weekend, Saturday, Sunday. We hope you will check that out. A lot of stuff, good stuff going on. Tournaments.drf.com. I want to thank Jonathan Kinchin. I do not want to thank Jonathan Kinchin's Wi-Fi situation. I want to thank Mike Hogan. I want to thank the guy putting up the pictures outside the studio for apparently taking an hour off. That was, I think, the one thing, tech speaking, that went right this show. Mike, good job on that, and good job by you. I want to thank everybody for listening, especially those of you listening on Spreaker, listening to us live, and also those who've taken the time to make comments on iTunes. It does really help and helps other people find the show and grow our community. We will be back next Monday. I'm sure you all are playing this weekend. May you win all your photos.